Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a report just released on the eve of the Geneva II peace talks by three leading war crimes and human rights prosecutors documenting industrial-scale killing of prisoners by Syria's Assad regime. The former medical director for the American Refugee Committee, Stephen Miles, a professor of medicine and bioethics at the University of Minnesota, where he is on the faculty of the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies, joins us. We will discuss the 55,000 photographs provided by a Syrian military police photographer whose job was to document the deaths by torture of 11,000 detainees for the Assads to show them that their orders had been executed. Then we'll examine the latest riots in Ukraine that have prompted Russia's foreign minister to accuse European governments of meddling in Ukraine's political crisis. A specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, Alexander Motel, a professor of political science at Rutgers University, joins us to discuss the Yanukovych regime's use of paid thugs, tatushki, to beat up peaceful demonstrators and provoke violence that allows the regime's and Russia's state television to broadcast images of burning buses and shops being looted to make the case for tough legislation and police action to stop the violence. Then finally, we'll do an update on an interview I did in October of last year with ex-CIA officer Robert Baer that first raised the question of whether or not Edward Snowden is a Russian intelligence asset who has been working for them all along. On Sunday's Meet the Press, the head of the House Intelligence Committee made a similar charge that Snowden stole a trove of secrets that had nothing to do with privacy and that it's no coincidence that Snowden ended up in the hands, the loving arms, of an FSB agent in Moscow. Robert Baer, a veteran CIA operations officer, joins us to analyze the evidence that might support these charges. And joining us now is Stephen Miles, who's a professor of medicine and bioethics at the University of Minnesota Medical School in Minneapolis. He is on the faculty for the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies and for the law school's concentration in health law and bioethics. He served as a medical director for the American Refugee Committee for 25 years, which included service as chief medical officer for 45,000 refugees on the Thai-Cambodian border and projects in Sudan, Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Indonesia, and the Thai-Burmese border. He is on the board of the Center for Victims of Torture, and his books include The Hippocratic Oath and the Ethics of Medicine and Oath Betrayed, America's Torture Doctors. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Miles.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
And a report has just come out from three former war crimes prosecutors, Sir Desmond De Silva, the former chief prosecutor for the Special Court for Sierra Leone, Sir Geoffrey Nice, the former lead prosecutor of former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic, and Professor David Crane, who indicted President Charles Taylor of Liberia at the Sierra Leone court. They have released a report having debriefed a Syrian military police photographer who supplied 55,000 pictures of the killings or the corpses of 11,000 detainees in what the prosecutors describe as industrial-scale killing by the Assad regime, reminiscent of World War II concentration camps of Belsen and Auschwitz. Have you looked at this report?
I've looked at the report and I've looked at the photographs, and this is an impressive human rights report. It's extraordinarily well documented.
So what are the implications then, given that this is on the eve of the Geneva II conference in Switzerland, at which the Assad regime will be meeting with the rebels? And the timing seems coincidental.
Right. The report actually shows industrial-style killing more on the range of what happened in Serbia under the Milosevic regime. Apparently what they're doing is taking prisoners and subjecting these prisoners to enormous deprivation. I was impressed by the degree of starvation of the bodies, in addition to various beatings and then a form of ligature strangulation in which bands are put around their necks. The abuses are horrendous, and they essentially mean that Assad's intention to run for re-election in a free and fair election is off the table. The question here is the issue whether he can have a negotiated retirement without being imprisoned for war crimes.
So the U.S. did not want Iran to attend the talks because, in Geneva, because they hadn't signed the Geneva One protocols, which involve easing Assad out or regime change. Now, the U.N. Invited Iran, and then the rebels said, we're not going to show up if Iran does, because they're paying for and their Revolutionary Guards are in fact, saving the Assad regime. So it looked like what happened in the end was that the UN decided that it was either going to be Iran or the rebels, and it was more important for the rebels to show up since they're half of the problem. Is that a summary?
I think that's a fair summary. The other issue is, of course, that the Iran regime itself has its own extensive record of torture and prisons. And at some point, the question of the accelerating pace of the prosecutions in real time of government leaders, including Doe and Milosevic, is something that is an issue for Iran as well as for Syria.
So it seems as though this does have echoes of the Nazi death camps with Dr. Mengele. And you are a medical doctor. And by the way, I spoke with a medical doctor fairly recently who's escaped from Syria. And she was telling me that her colleagues, when the revolution first began, they were rounded up by the regime and tortured. And when they were let out of prison, they were on their way out. The prison doctor injected them with AIDS or hepatitis, giving them a terminal disease. And that seems to be the Syrian military photographer. His job was to document all of these corpses, and apparently he paid a huge psychological price for doing this work. And the reason he was documenting the torture and the bodies was that the regime wanted these for their files, if you will, but they also wanted to provide the families with a death certificate without having to show them the body. So in other words, his job was to confirm to the regime that the orders had been carried out and these people had been killed, at the same time provide photographs that would prevent the families from viewing the bodies. So how does this strike you?
Doctors are intimately tied up with torture around the world, and one can see a map of this at doctorswhotorture.com. But the doctors have several functions in torture. Number one, they falsify medical records and death certificates to conceal the torture, and that seems to have been the purpose of this effort. The second thing that doctors do is for people who aren't supposed to die, they allow the torture to be titrated in a way that will not kill the prisoner. And in regimes that don't leave scar torture, and this is not the Assad regime strategy, they devise methods of torture that doesn't leave scars. Now, the Assad regime seems to be using its medical system simply to create medical evidence and to falsify death certificates and to deny that torture occurs. This is only one use, though, of torture in the medical regime by the Assad regime, which also was invading hospitals during the early part of the street riots in Syria, and were torturing people in the hospitals while forcing the medical persons to stand by and watch.
And is this documented as well?
This is well documented, and there's an extensive photographic evidence of this taken by cell phones in these hospitals that can easily be found online.
So this evidence that you've just suggested had been compiled earlier when the regime was going into hospitals and those that were wounded and shot in the first street protests were tortured openly, and that was recorded. And now we have this defector codenamed Caesar, who's shown up with 55,000 photographs. His job was to document the bodies as they came out of Assad's prisons, 11,000 people that he'd documented, and apparently this caused a psychological weight on him, and apparently he had defected to the opposition and provided this photographic evidence, which three very, very highly regarded former human rights prosecutors now have. Will this be forwarded to the International Criminal Court?
I'm sure that it will be forwarded to the International Criminal Court, which is already looking at the issue on Assad. The question of whether this rises to the level of genocide is a somewhat separate question, but it certainly represents crimes against humanity, and it certainly represents torture. And in the past, say 30 years ago, Assad might have been given a villa somewhere, say in Saudi Arabia, to retire to and escape prosecution in exchange for allowing for an orderly transfer of power. These types of deals are becoming much less common. It was done, for example, with Papa Doc and with Idi Amin. And now the question, I think, for President Assad is essentially going to be the question of how he hands over power with essentially no guarantees on escaping a war crimes indictment.
So are there places that he could go to?
Yeah, it is possible. I can imagine a circumstance under which, for example, Russia might agree to take Syria in, or possibly Iran, both of which have been supporting the regime against the insurgents, and essentially airlifting him out as some sort of interim government came in. It's an interesting possibility. It certainly wouldn't be the type of negotiated amnesty. It would be essentially an evacuation.
And the idea that this is an industrial-style killing, as this report suggests, does have echoes, of course, of going back to the Nazis. Have you seen anything since the Holocaust in Nazi Germany of industrial-scale killing? You mentioned Serbia.
We've had a number of instances of killing on this scale, and this is not on the scale of the Nazis. This is more on the level of Serbia. It's not on the scale of Cambodia. It's more on the level of, say, China or Zimbabwe or possibly Sudan. But this is, I think it's easy to go to the Nazi analogy right away because we think of the Nazi analogy, but around 120 countries practice torture. This is more more on the scale of Serbia or Iran, something like that.
Well, apparently this defector, the military police photographer who took all of these pictures, that was his job, to document those that were killed, to show the regime that the orders had been carried out, and to provide their family with a picture as opposed to viewing the corpse, and the regime would tell the family that he died from a heart attack. Caesar told these human rights lawyers that he, along with a doctor and a member of the judiciary, would examine the corpses. So there again you have more evidence of the medical profession being deeply involved in the regime's human rights abuses.
Absolutely. The medical regime seems to be heavily involved, and that's not a surprise. The other thing that's not a surprise is the obsessive documentation of human rights abuses of these torturing regimes. We're seeing, for example, these documents surfacing and being used very effectively in prosecutions currently happening in Guatemala and also in Brazil and Argentina. And I don't know what it is about these satanic dictators. They just love to keep detailed records. The Nazis, of course, were very good at keeping records, and that was part of the enormous museum called the Vod in Israel.
But my understanding is that the Assad regime were able to convince the world for the longest time that he was a modernizing force. He was a medical doctor practicing in London when he was recalled to take over the family dynasty, political dynasty. And he His wife, for example, was featured in Vogue magazine in a big fluff piece saying how what a great fashion icon she was and how she was modernizing Syria. So presumably that was their PR effort up until this war began. And this war began because of their actions. They were the ones who decided to kill their people rather than allow their people to have democracy or have some semblance of democracy. So is he vulnerable or does he not care? I mean, I'm not asking you to psychoanalyze this guy, but, you know, give me a sense of this contradiction between this so-called modern family and what they do in their own dungeons.
I think it's a fascinating question. Of course, to some degree, the glamorization of these dictators is easy because glamour is public and the torture is secret. But what's so fascinating about the Assad case is that in most regimes now, they've switched to non-scarifying, non-disfiguring torture in order to not create a graphic public record. And this is done to preserve the semblance of democracy. For example, the question of using suffocation methods, false executions, that kind of thing. But by Assad shifting to scarifying torture and mutilating torture in the manner that he's done, basically what he's done is he said that I'm not interested in the possibility of a transition to a democratic form of government. I'm going to maintain my government by fascist types of power and fear. And so the regimes that use non-scarifying torture tend to be the ones that want to maintain the pretense of democracy.
So you're suggesting here, Stephen Miles, that, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that this is hardly a coincidence that this report came out. I think this fellow, Caesar, defected some time ago on the eve of the Geneva II talks,
right,
and that Assad, you know, basically is in a situation where he won't be able to. I mean, his bottom line in these negotiations is my tenure is not negotiable. And up until the rebels agreed to go to Geneva under pressure from the U.S. and the U.N., they were saying that, you know, Assad continuing is not negotiable. So somehow they're going to try and finesse this in these talks. What do you think is going to come out of these talks if indeed, as you say, at the end of the day, Assad will probably end up in Russia?
Well, I think that one of the things that this report has done is it has removed the possibility of another election to serve as a plebiscite on the Assad regime, and that essentially Assad now has the option not so much of an amnesty, but a flat-out escape and concealment in the countries of some of his supporters. And so that the option for the Geneva conference has dropped from three options, that is, escape, another attempted election or transition government, to two. He can do an escape, or there'll be a transition without an escape, in which case he winds up looking like El Duce hanging from a meat hook out in the public square.
Well, Stephen Miles, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Miles, who's a professor of medicine and bioethics at the University of Minnesota Medical School. He's on the faculty for the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies and for the law school's concentration in health law and bioethics, and served as medical director for the American Refugee Committee for 25 years, including service on the Thai-Cambodian border, Sudan, Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Indonesia, and the Thai-Burmese border. He is on the board of the Center for Victims of Torture, and his books include The Hippocratic Oath and the Ethics of Medicine, and Oath Betrayed, America's Torture Doctors. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the new round of protests in the Ukraine.